From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, Peter Sakrowski, an Austrian Jew, discusses his new book, Born Guilty, Children of Nazi Families. Also today, I speak with rapper Kool Moe Dee. When he started rapping a decade ago, people thought it was just a fad. But rap is still going strong, and so is Kool Moe Dee. And on his new album, he asks his listeners, how you like me now? Rhythm guitarist Marty Gross pays tribute to Fats Waller in our performance spot, and critic Ken Tucker reviews Penn and Teller's Cruel Tricks for Dear Friends, a new home video featuring some of the magical duo's favorite scams. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Peter Sakrowski is a Jew who grew up in post-war Austria. Many of his schoolmates were the sons and daughters of Nazis. How do the children of killers live together in the same country with the children of victims? This question has haunted him for years. He posed the question to the children of Jewish survivors in his book Strangers in Their Own Land, Young Jews in Germany and Austria Today. Sakrowski gave himself a more difficult task for his new book, Born Guilty. He interviewed the sons and daughters of Nazis and probed their feelings about their parents' participation in the extermination of Jews. Peter Sakrowski lives in Austria, where he's a freelance writer and the author of several best-selling books published in German. I spoke with him from the NPR Bureau in New York. He told me why he followed up his book on the children of survivors with a book from the perspective of men and women whose parents were Nazis.
When I finished the other book, 1985, after it came out, I was interested in the what I called the other side. And I was looking for books and studies, and I didn't find one. So it was almost a reaction to the silence that I started to interview people whom I know and from whom I know that they came from Nazi families, who described their parents before as being involved in the SS or in the Nazi movement. And this is how everything started. So I actually started in my own surrounding, because I lived in Berlin at that time, and started to talk to people whom I know.
You grew up in Austria, going to school with the children of former Nazis. Did you think about that a lot when you were growing up, and How in what ways did that influence the friendships that you made?
When I think back, it was never a question. It was never discussed between friends of mine and me. It was never discussed in school with other boys or girls. Maybe it was at the age when I started to study in Austria, I started to ask other people, well, what did your father do during the war? Or was this ever discussed in your family? This was about the age when I started to ask questions, because I was always used to tell what happened to my parents, but they never told me something about their parents. But when I think back, it was never a problem, I would say, before I was maybe 20 or 22 or 23.
What made it a problem when it hadn't been one before?
My questions made it a problem. For instance, I remember a situation when I was in London as a student. There was a German student, and we went out, and I told her the story about my parents who stayed in London during the war, and then I asked her, what did your father do? And she said, well, he was in the SS. Finished. And so, well, and then I started to ask questions. Well, what did he do there? She said, I don't know. She said, did you ask him where he was? She said, no. I said, was this never discussed in your family, what the father did? She said, no. Then I asked her, well, maybe he's a murderer. Maybe he was involved in the worst war crimes. Then she says, well, I never asked him. And this is how all this kind of conversation started.
So you wanted to find out some of the questions that even the children of former Nazis were afraid to find out or didn't know about.
I was interested. It was impossible for me to imagine that in these families, nobody ever talked about all this.
You interviewed several children who were from Nazi families. And did you find that most of them were willing to talk with you about this, especially since they knew that you were Jewish and that it would be talking to someone who would probably be passing judgment on them in a way that an interviewer who was also a son or a daughter of Germans who had been in the Nazi movement wouldn't be passing judgment on them?
It was very different. Some of them really wanted to talk because there was a lot of pressure on them because they have never talked before about that, and they were very glad that they were able to talk. It was a very interesting situation sometimes. I always made the interviews in hotel rooms, and sometimes I had the microphone there and the tape recorder, and they started to talk and talk and talk and couldn't stop. And others I called and wanted to persuade them and ask them if they would give me an interview, and they said no, I don't want to talk to you because I know what you expect me to say. So they thought that I expect from them that they are going to criticize their parents, which was not true. I was interested in their relationship to the parents.
You did these interviews in hotel rooms that would be on neutral ground?
Yes, I never wanted to visit them at home. And I never talked to the parents. I only talked to the children.
My guest is Peter Sikorsky, and we're talking about his new book, Born Guilty, Children of Nazi Families. And Sikorsky is himself an Austrian who is Jewish. One of the things that really surprised me reading through your interviews is how little so many of the people who you interviewed knew about at what level their parents participated in the war and in the Nazi death camps. How did they end up growing up and knowing so little? Is it that they didn't want to know, that their parents didn't want to talk about it?
Well, almost all of them described the first 15 years of their life that they accepted everything that came from the parents. So if the father said, well, I was a soldier like everybody else, they accepted it. And very often they got the different information from outside. Or they found documents, or they found a picture. And then, you know, when they were 15 or 16, they learned in school about the SS, the war and everything. So they came home and looked at the picture where the father was in an SS uniform. So they asked the father, well, what kind of uniform is this? And then they started to give answers, but they always defended themselves. As one girl, one woman describes her situation in the book, that she, when she was 14, a letter came, and it came out that the father was brought to court because it was the member of the SS guard in a concentration camp. Again, the information came from outside. And then these children confronted their parents. They said, well, what is the truth now? You always told me this, and now I hear this. And then the parents constantly defended themselves. But very soon then the children found out that most of the parents were lying about their past. There was no single interview I made where a man or a woman told me, I knew exactly what my parents did. I knew exactly what my father did. It was always like a fog, you know. They could always, there was no clear picture about the past of the parents.
Although this kind of information about the parents' participation in the war wasn't passed on, was there any anti-Semitism that was passed on from the parents to the children?
There was always anti-Semitism or anti-Semitic statements by the parents, but not only against the Jews. I mean, all of the children described their parents as people who remain in the way of thinking after 1945. So they described them as being Nazis also when the Nazi time was over. So it was against all the statements against criminals, against Jews, against Russians, very often also against Americans. I mean, the typical way of thinking for a Nazi continued in the families. And some of them even describe themselves as children as being victims of Nazis because they had to live with Nazi parents. For instance, one told me in an interview that he feels like he was the Jew in the family.
And he said that he thought you were better off than he was.
Yeah, this is one of the most ridiculous interviews I made because he really had a desire of being a victim. He wanted to prove me that he was the real victim because for me, he told me, for you the war is over. Your parents survived and you're living with, at least you're living with parents who are no Nazi, but I had to live with Nazis. till I lived at home, which was 20 years after the war.
Well, that's one extreme that emerged, and there's two other extremes, I think, that emerged. On the one hand, you had some of the children who really broke off from their parents and felt that they just couldn't deal with, that they didn't want to be a part of their parents' complicity in the war. And these are the children who didn't even invite their parents to their own weddings. On the other side, you have someone like the woman who you call Stephanie, who feels that the war criminals have been tried. She's not guilty. She had nothing to do with it. And she really thinks her sister is crazy for having joined all these new peace groups. And I think you say at the end of your book that it's this interview with the woman who feels no guilt whatsoever, that was the most controversial of all the interviews when the book was published in Germany.
Yes, she's interesting because she's 19 years old. She's actually the third generation, and she's talking about her grandfather, who was executed in Nuremberg. The problem with the new generation now is that many of them don't accept that they are children or grandchildren of Nazis or war criminals. They say, and the problem of this generation is that the whole education of the third generation was very different to the second generation. Today in school, like Stephanie says in her interview, they see films of concentration camps, they see pictures, they hear from the teachers almost every day, every week, and they can't hear it anymore. They say, why do we have to listen to all this every day, every week, every year? Why do I have to see all these pictures? I didn't do anything, my friends didn't do anything. Even my parents didn't do anything because they were born after the war. So why should I be confronted with all this constantly? And in a way, she's quite right, I think, even if this would sound strange, because you have a teacher generation today in Germany who show it in a very powerful way to children who are between maybe 15 and 18, who really can't deal with the whole situation. They don't know what to do with it. And again, you have a teacher generation today who do not talk about it as being a part of their own family history, of the history of the town, of the history of the school, talking about the teachers who worked. You know, it's always presented as a part of the history lesson in Germany. And I think today, you know, Germans always talk about the collective guilt. You know, they don't want to accept collective guilt. But there is much more work done with guilt now in the German schools and in among the Germans than from outside into Germany.
Well, you also express a concern about collective amnesia.
Yeah. Well, this is the other side of collective guilt. You know, when everybody's guilty, nobody's guilty. This is a ridiculous statement. And when I went to school, the Holocaust, the Second World War, was no question. Nobody talked about it. There was no information at all. I didn't learn about the Holocaust in school. Nobody learned in the 50s and the 60s. But what is now going on, I think, is the opposite, which is as worse as what they did before.
Your book has been published in Germany. It's also been published in Austria. And you said that the reaction in Germany was the book was very controversial. Everybody was talking about it. You were getting called up to participate in panel discussions and to do a lot of public speaking. But when the book was published in Austria, there was no such reaction. It was kind of greeted with quiet. What do you think is responsible for the different receptions your book has gotten, or the subject has gotten, in both countries?
Well, Austria still sees itself today as being the first victim of the Nazis. And when you publish a book about children of Nazis, the first reaction is say, well, we didn't have any Nazis, it were the Germans.
I should mention that the Nazis invaded Austria exactly 50 years ago.
Today, 50 years ago, yeah. And the problem is that Austria never accepted their own responsibility in the whole in the participation in the Holocaust and in the Second World War, and it is slowly starting, and that during the last 2 years, that scientists and politicians and all kind of different groups are rewriting Austrian history concerning these years. And so the reaction in Austria was very, very was silence. it was unbelievable. Only when last November, Born Guilty, the book, also came out as a play in Vienna. And it was a very important, very big theater who put it on stage. Then a lot of people reacted, and the play was always sold out. The play was a great success. And then also the press started to write about it.
I want to talk with you more about your research and about your own life, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Austrian writer Peter Sakrowski, whose new book, Born Guilty, is based on his interviews with the children of former Nazis. He lives in Austria now. We'll talk more after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
Austrian writer Peter Sakrowski is my guest, author of Born Guilty, Children of Nazi Families. We've talked a little bit about some of the responses you got from the people who you interviewed. I'm interested in your responses to what they told you. I get the impression from your book that you really have no understanding or sympathy for those children who condemn what their parents did but feel sorry for themselves. Would you explain that? I feel that you're not interested in empathizing with them.
Well, the whole work and all the interviews helped me to understand in what difficulties situation they are. But I have difficulties in feeling sorry for them, especially those who always presented themselves as being victims of their parents. I mean, we're talking today about men and women who are in the 40s, and some of them moved out, left home when they were 18 or 20, when they finished study, and they had at least between 10 and 20 years, they had time to develop their own life and to emancipate themselves. And some of them still say everything that they are today is a result of the treatment and the education, the influence of their parents. And with this situation, I had really difficulties.
You write that for the children of Nazis, the unconditional love of parents is an indulgence they cannot afford. Do you think that the children of Nazi parents should, openly condemn their parents and break with them in some way?
No, I never expected this, and I think what I wanted to say is that if you don't question, and if you don't ask your parents what they did, if you don't take the risk to get an answer that is very uncomfortable for you, then you have no right to accept your parents like they are today. One woman, for instance, told me in an interview that she doesn't want to talk to her mother anymore because she has the feeling that that her mother lied all the years. So I asked her, why was it? What was so terrible what your mother did? And she said, this is not the question what they did during the war. It's the problem what she did afterwards when she lived together with me. And then she said, I would accept her, I would love her, even if she would have been a member of the guard in a concentration camp, if she wouldn't have lied to me. If she would have told me I was young at that time, what I did was wrong, I recognize today what I did, and I'm going to try to do everything that you are different to me. Then she said, I would be glad to have a mother like this. So it's not the problem what they did. All the problems the children that of the Nazis have with their parents today is because of how they behaved after the war, because they lied to the children, because they never changed after 45. This is the problem, the relationship to the Nazi parents.
I'm interested in what it was like for you growing up in Austria as a Jew after the war. Both of your parents fled their countries either right before or right after the Nazis invaded. Your father was from Austria. He left his parents to flee the country to escape the Nazis. Your mother was from Prague. She left her mother to flee the Nazis. And your grandparents all were killed by the Nazis, but your parents were survivors.
Yes.
Why did they go to Austria after the war was over. I think they'd been living in Belgium, is that right?
No, they lived in England. Then
okay.
My father was a British soldier, and he came back in the British British uniform. And, well, they had the idea, they were very young, they were 22 and 23 after the war, and they had the idea that there is a chance to build up a new Austria with a new identity.
With a new Jewish community?
No, not so much with the Jewish community. This was not the question. You know, my father always told me when he was in London, there was like a community of victims. And it doesn't matter if somebody was Jewish or he was Catholics and therefore left the country, or he was a communist. So shortly after the war, there was their friends that were from... They had to leave the country for many different reasons. And this was a basic community. My parents always thought would be also a basic for the rebuild or a new Austria, which was not true, we know today, because Austria wasn't interested in the immigrants who came back. It were the more or less the old Nazis who continued to be in power, and they built the new Austria.
Are you ever sorry that they decided to return to Austria and that you ended up growing up Jewish among former Nazis and the children of former Nazis?
Well, this is a question that's going on in our family since really I can't think back. I always ask them, why didn't you stay in London? And they say, well, we feel Austrian. And I criticized them very much till about 10 years ago. Today I realize that I'm also Austrian. You know, the family of my father lived in Vienna since 200, 300 years. And there's a lot in my own personality that has to do with Vienna, with Austria. And there is no borderline between Jewish and Viennese. There is a lot that cannot be divided in the two parts. And I mean
culturally.
Culturally, the language, the whole identity. You know, I don't know who I am. I can't answer you the question. Am I Jewish or am I Viennese? Where's the difference?
So that's part of the reason why you've decided to stay yourself.
Yeah, I left Vienna in 1980. I was 4 years in Berlin, 1 year in New York. So altogether, I was away from Vienna for 7 years. Now I am back since 1.5 years. And I don't know if I'm going to stay, but I like the town and I like to stay there too.
It seems to me it would be much easier to grow up bitter being a Jew in Austria or Germany than it would be being the child of survivors growing up in, say, the United States or in England, because you're constantly surrounded by things that would remind you of the camps and of all the mass murders.
Well, the silence in Vienna, at least till 2 years ago, was also quite comfortable, because nobody talked about the past. Nobody talked about the Holocaust. Nobody talked about Nazis, about war crimes. So sometimes I'm almost glad that it was not a part of my youth.
I guess one of the things you really have to think about, because of your life and because of the research that you're doing, is at what point do people get a fresh start and break with the past, if ever? You know, at what point are you as an individual willing to accept the children of Nazis, and at what point are they willing to accept you? Do you feel that you're any place, or that they're any place close to that point?
I have many friends who come from Nazi families. I think it's a very personal decision if you try to prove yourself and the others that you're somebody else than your parents or your grandparents. And I don't criticize anybody because of his parents or grandparents. The title of my book, Born Guilt, is not a statement that I'm making. It's a statement by one of the interviewers. They feel born guilty. And I only have problems with those who accept their parents, doesn't matter what they did. Then I have problems with them. But it's their own decision. It's not the history of their parents. For instance, Niklas Frank, who is the son of Hans Frank, who was executed in the Nuremberg trial, is a very good friend of mine.
In your previous book, your book about young Jews in Germany and Austria today, you wrote that you felt that although you had never been a religious Jew, that you were ready to start living as a Jew. What did you mean by that? And have you acted on that since you wrote that? Has your identity as a Jew changed, or have you been living any differently than you were when you wrote it?
Well, I accepted the history in my family, and which means that there is a cultural history, even if I'm not religious. And I, for instance, I joined the Viennese Jewish community a year ago, and I go to the clubs and I try to meet people there. I go to discussions, which I didn't did before. So I'm more and more interested who are the people, what is going on there. I try to help them when they need me because of the publicity I have now. So this is what I'm doing now.
What effect would you like to see your research have on people in Germany and Austria?
Well, for me, the question was always interesting. Who is the new German? Who is the new Austrian? Is he really different, or is he the same? If you look at all the excuses the war generation gave us for what they did, for instance, like the economic situation was terrible. They had no jobs. They had nothing to eat. What does it mean for the new Germans? Does it mean there are no Nazis because the economic situation is okay? Does it mean for us that we have to be careful when they have no jobs and then when they are hungry? Will they behave like their parents and grandparents? These are all questions. If we want to be sure that there is a new democratic Germany and a new democratic Austria, it means there are new people there with a new democratic identity. But how can they prove? How can they prove us and them that they're really different to their parents and grandparents?
I know you have no answers to these questions. Obviously, nobody can. But what's your gut feeling now to the question of can this ever happen again in Germany?
Thinking about the lies that and all everything that was going on in these Nazi families, it made the second and third generation very difficult for them to develop into other people, which means I'm not so sure, like all the other people, especially the people outside of Germany who think today Germany is a very, very strong democracy. I don't know why they think in this way. Maybe the percentage of democratic people increased from, I don't know what, before the war, 10% to 20% today. But I don't know how the majority would react in a difficult situation in Austria and Germany today. I really don't know. I don't have an answer. And I'm a little bit afraid when the economic situation would change and would be comparable to the 30s and the 20s.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you for being with us.
Okay, thank you.
My guest has been Austrian writer Peter Sakrowski. He's a Jew living in Austria. He was born there, grew up there. His new book is titled Born Guilty, Children of Nazi Families. His previous book, Strangers in Their Own Land, was about young Jews in Germany and Austria today. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Nick Kotz, author of the new book Wild Blue Yonder, Money, Politics, and the B-1 Bomber. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Kool Moe Dee says he's the best rapper around, and he backs up his claim with his new album, How You Like Me Now. We'll talk about his 10 years in rap music. Also in our performance spot, a couple of Fats Waller songs interpreted by rhythm guitarist Marty Gross. And critic Ken Tucker checks out some new home videos, including Penn and Teller's Cruel Tricks for Dear Friends, a collection of the magical duo's favorite scams. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Lori Waffenschmidt. Former National Security Advisor Robert McFarlane today pleaded guilty to 4 misdemeanor charges arising from the Iran-Contra affair. He admitted withholding information from Congress in 1985 and 1986 about Reagan administration efforts to fund the Nicaraguan Contras during a statutory ban. McFarlane later spoke with reporters outside U.S. District Court in Washington.
Told all that I know. And it's on the public record for everyone to see. And I intend to remain available to repeat it for as long as it's necessary to bring this matter to a conclusion.
McFarlane's guilty plea is part of a plea bargaining deal with Iran-Contra Special Prosecutor Lawrence Walsh. Walsh says McFarlane's cooperation is important to the ongoing criminal probe of the Iran-Contra affair. McFarlane faces a possible 4-year prison term and up to $400,000 in fines. The Reagan administration ordered a new set of economic sanctions against Panama today in its latest bid to force the ouster of military strongman General Manuel Noriega. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
President Reagan suspended trade preferences available to Panama worth an estimated $96 million a year. He also ordered increased scrutiny of Panamanians by immigration and customs officials, in his words, to apprehend drug traffickers and money launderers. The president directed that a $6.5 million payment due this month to Panama from the U.S.-controlled Panama Canal Commission be placed in escrow. Speaking for the administration, Secretary of State George Shultz says he hopes the measures will hasten Noriega's departure.
And that civilian control of the government of Panama will take up. And the Panamanian Defense Forces will be able to resume a significant and honorable role in support of that constitutionally proper regime.
The sanctions order today falls short of stronger measures called for by many in Congress. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
On the West Bank today, more than half the Arab police force reportedly quit to protest the Israeli occupation. There was trouble in Gaza City as well, where troops closed the main Muslim mosque for the first time in memory. At least 9 Palestinian protesters were injured in street fighting in several areas. Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir today totally rejected U.S. proposals for Arab-Israeli peace. In an interview with Israeli radio, Shamir charged the U.S. plan was chosen mostly according to Arab tastes. Shamir assured Jewish settlers today that he will not give in to U.S. pressure to accept negotiations aimed at exchanging land for peace with Palestinians in the occupied territories. The prime minister said he will unveil his suggestions for making the plan more acceptable when he arrives in Washington on Monday. Gary Hart today quit the race for the Democratic presidential nomination. It's the second time he has made the announcement. Hart dropped out in May because of a scandal over his relationship with a young Florida woman. In December, he shocked the political world by announcing he was back in the race, saying he would let the people decide whether he should be president. Today, the former Colorado senator held a news conference in Denver to say his campaign is over.
The people are the strength of this country. I said I wanted them to decide about my candidacy. I got a fair hearing, and the people have decided, and now I clearly should not go forward.
Meanwhile, in Chicago, Robert Dole spent the day campaigning and trying to put down rumors that he's about to quit the presidential race. Yesterday, Dole withdrew about $400,000 worth of TV ads and laid off a number of campaign workers. But Dole insists he is in the race to stay. The Chicago Tribune today endorsed Dole. Polls show the Senate minority leader far behind frontrunner George Bush in Tuesday's Illinois primary. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose almost 9 points, closing the week at 2034.98. Advances led declines 4-3 on volume of 201 million shares. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Marty Gross is one of a handful of guitarists who keep alive the art of jazz rhythm guitar. He most typically performs songs from the 20s, 30s, and 40s. On today's performance spot, an encore presentation, Marty Gross with a couple of tunes written by one of his greatest inspirations, Fats Waller.
Mischief now, really am in love and how I'm through playing with fire. It's you whom I desire, all the world can plainly see. You're the only one for me. I've told them all in advance, they can't break up our romance, no living up to every vow. I'm keeping out of mischief now, yeah. Mischief now, really am in love and how I'm through playing with fire. It's you whom I desire, all the world can plainly see. You're the only one for me, babe. I have told them all in advance, they can't break up our romance, no living. Living up to every vow, I'm keeping out of mischief now, babe. I'm keeping out of mischief now, fat mama. I'm keeping out of mischief now. That was Keeping Out of Mischief by Thomas Fats Waller, a man who lived an exuberant, exciting life, wrote hundreds of songs, and some of them, like that last one, were tinted with the feeling of remorse and contrition, like his other songs, Ain't Misbehavin' and Please Get Me Out of Jail. Apparently, he spent some of his time paying for his high life in the 20s and early 30s by spending time in jail for not paying alimony. But his exuberance and his love of life and his composing talents come to life in a song like this next one called I'm Crazy About My Baby. Goes something like this.
I'm walking on air, 'cause I've left all my blue days behind. I've learned how to care, 'cause there's love, really love, on my mind. I'm the world's most happy creature. Tell me, what can worry be? I'm crazy about my baby. My baby's crazy about me. Cupid was the teacher, he and I agree. I'm crazy about my baby. My baby's crazy about me. Parson, get that book out, ready in your hand. Keep a lookout, you can understand. We're an A1 combination, a perfect he and she. I'm crazy about my baby. My baby's crazy about me. My baby's crazy about me. My baby's crazy about me. Oh, ding dong, ding dong. Tingling, tingling, tingling. Ring long, ding dong. Wedding bells for baby and me. Zaddy, daddy, daddy, dozo, zomba, zappa, tappa, tappa, Gilbert Sullivan. I was so very serious by when I polish up the handles on the big brass door. My baby's crazy about me. Thank you. happy creature. What can worry be? I'm crazy about my baby. My baby's crazy about me. Cupid was the teacher. He and I agree. I'm crazy about my baby. My baby's crazy about me. Oh, Parson, get that book out. Steady in your hand. Keep a lookout, you can understand. We're an A1 combination of perfect he and she. I'm crazy about my baby. My baby's crazy about me. My baby's crazy about me.
Mardi Gross lives in Piermont, New York. His latest recording, Mardi Gross and His Keepers of the Flame, is on Stomp Off Records. This is Fresh Air. That's Cool Moe Dee from his latest album, How You Like Me Now. Fresh Air rock critic Ken Tucker said that this album completely contradicts the usual complaint that all rap sounds the same. Cool Moe Dee has been rapping for nearly a decade and considers himself part of what he calls the old school.
We thought that it was just going to be a fad, and we didn't even look at it as a business whatsoever. It was really about, notoriety, getting popular in the streets, and just a way to get some attention and blow off a lot of steam and meet females and things like that. So the new school rappers come in with the philosophy to get paid and do whatever it takes to get paid. The old school rappers were basically there to try to create or be as creative as they possibly could. So it's more or less like the artist versus the businessman.
On your record, How You Like Me Now, you talk about how a lot of rappers are using the style they learned from you and saying that they're the best. Do you feel that way a lot, that a lot of people have like taken your style?
I don't really feel that they've taken it. It's more or less, I say, adapted to. I think I was really ahead of my time as far as rap is concerned. Basically, what I mean by that is I was the first one to use, innovative rhythms and syncopation and utilize a lot of vocabulary in my raps. And now, today, I mean, I was doing that in 1981, and it's just, catching on today. But this specific message was basically to the whole rap community, because they had always said that I was good on stage and pretty good, as far as making rhymes. But as far as producing records, I didn't really have what it takes. So that's what How You Like Me Now was about.
Well, you showed him.
I throw my tape on, then I watch you 3 seconds later. I got you shaking your head, dancing instead of sitting. The rhymes kick, the beat's hitting you just like a home run, slamming like a slam dunk. Ride the wave, James Brown, K-Funk, it happened to James like it happened to me. How you think it feel to see another MC get paid? Using my rap style, and I'm playing the background. Meanwhile, I ain't with that, you can't forget that, you took my style. I'm taking it back, coming back, like Return of the Jedi. Sucker MCs in the place that said I could only rock rhymes and only rock crowds, but never rock records. How you like me now?
Do you have any favorite rhymes of the ones you've come up with?
Of the ones I come up with?
Yeah.
it's too long and complex to get into here, but it's one that starts off with my voice is auriferous, coming out an orifice, expressing hyperbole, verbally orifice, mental isometrics that makes you so electric. And it goes on that vibe. That's like my favorite rhyme.
I have another record I want to ask you about. It's 50 Ways, and you use as the background riff the 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover from the Paul Simon record. Now, how'd you get the idea to do that one?
Okay, everybody was pressuring me to do a ballad, a rap ballad, and I just would not feel comfortable on stage with the semi-hard image saying I need love. It's just not me, so I had to come up with something similar, you know, to like a love song, but make it more arrogant. So 50 Ways is more like a love song. Not really a love song. It's like saying, if I want you, I can get you. It's more like cocky.
I'll ask you for a play today, and if you say no, it's okay. Cause I'll just sit back and lay, cause it's a matter of time. Cause if I wanna be with ya, I'll take my money and bet ya. If I really, really want you, I can get ya by the end of this rhyme.
50 ways, 50 ways, 50 ways.
Do you have to get permission from the record company or anything like that before you use an excerpt of someone's record on your record?
Technically, you don't. If you remake the record, you definitely have to do it. I'm not exactly sure what the real lore is, but I know it's like you have to have at least 8 bars or something like that before they can say something. And by just sampling the word 50 ways or whatever, it's like there's no real rights to that.
When did you first start rapping?
1978.
How did you start doing it?
I was out there when it started in the parks. It was just like a fad, just like skateboards and things like that. You know, rapping was like the thing to do at the time that I was coming up.
Were there competitions between rappers?
Oh, it's been that way ever since. That's why it's so competitive now. The roots still stayed there. Your rhymes were designed to tell the community that you were better than the next guy that you were going to hear on the mic or the last guy you heard on the mic. But, you know, like I said, people love competition, so I guess that's what makes it work.
You have a rap on your new record called Wild Wild West that's basically about gangs coming in and busting up parties and things like that on your block and in your neighborhood. Did parties where you were rapping get crashed a lot by gangs, violent gangs?
Not really a lot. What I was addressing there, the message wasn't about really gangs crashing up parties and things. What I was saying in that is, you know, nowadays people are, you know, utilizing guns and nobody wants to fight anymore. It's like if somebody steps on your shoe, you go inside, you get a gun and you shoot them. And I'm trying to make the point that, you know, we are one of the last places that you can get a real fight because we're men. So I'm trying to implant that in everyone's head and make them feel that you're not a man every time you pick up a gun.
One day, the fellas got together, they vowed that no one would ever come in our block and terrorize us. The gangs that used to do it, now they idolize us. Guns, we don't like to use them unless our enemies choose them. We prefer to fight you all like a man and beat you down with our hands and body slam you at the Wild Wild West. The Wild Wild West.
You also say that gangs that used to terrorize you idolize you now because you're a rapper. Is that true?
Yes, that is true. A lot of gangs, they would just start fights and things just to disrupt the party, you know, create some kind of chaos or mayhem. And it's like I kind of killed them with kindness, put it that way, you know, by knowing that what they were doing to the parties and things like that and never really, really taking action and, you know, constantly explaining to them that they didn't have to do that, you know, through records and things like that. And, you know, the success, it's like it's almost to the point where they're proud to see somebody from their neighborhood, you know, do something positive.
What did you think of it when commercials on television, like hamburger commercials and tinfoil commercials, started using rap music to promote their products?
I had mixed emotions. Number one, I was proud and I was happy that, you know, it had reached a level where, you know, the American mainstream America was taking notice that this is an art form that can really, you know, have some type of longevity. What I didn't like about it is it's like they never got any real rappers to do anything. It's not like we were behind the scenes writing the commercials or writing the raps or even doing voiceovers, which is, you know, a lot of another way of, you know, making money in terms of, you know, from the business aspect. So I was a little upset with that. And it's like, you know, we're writing the rappers and, I mean, we're writing the raps and things like that. And then some producer gets some network writer to write a rap commercial and it doesn't really come off the way rap really's done. So it was like it wasn't really authentic, although it helped rap in a certain, to one aspect, it didn't really help it in another aspect.
You've made it clear that you want to see rap have longevity, and you know, you'd like to be able to keep performing it. Now, I think in some ways you're one of the older rappers. Do you want to make sure that rap isn't a form that's just for teenagers? That you can still keep doing it as you get a little bit older?
Definitely. That's another thing I'm trying to get through as far as, you know, the message or the lyrics that I write about, you know, things I write about. Because a lot of the success or lack of success from rappers comes because they're writing about things that only they can relate to. I think what they need to do is start, you know, addressing social issues and things like that. And just talking about things that are relative on a more national basis than just a local neighborhood or this apartment in my building or something like that.
When you're putting together a rap, do you mostly improvise it or do you sit down and actually like plan out what the rhymes are going to be and the rhythms?
Always plan. It's like I sit down, I write titles first. I like what subject do I want to talk about, you know, and then I get all of the words that relate to the title. And then after all the words fall in, and I start scratching out and checking which ones I want to keep and which ones I don't want to use, and then I go over it, and I write and I say, nah, that's not good enough, and I keep going over it and over and over it, and then, you know, finally I'll say, forget it. And then I listen to another rap record and say, yeah, well, it's better than that, so I'll do it.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Kool Moe Dee's new album, How You Like Me Now, is on the Jive label.
Continue, there's more on the menu, but I relax cause I'm so far in you. You had enough, I know you're overstuffed, and if I keep going, you'll be throwing up. Oh, rhymes I used to say way back in the day, when you used to come to my parties and pay. Nobody's ever gonna rock me in this side vow, so all I wanna say is how you like me now.
This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Renee Montaigne and see what they have planned. Hi, Renee.
Hi.
What story is he following?
We have a story tonight on President Reagan imposing more economic sanctions on Panama. These sanctions are expected to create even more problems for Manuel Noriega. Panama's economy has already suffered from the effects of the cutoff of U.S. aid and the freezing of its assets in the United States. Also, a report tonight on Gallaudet University. Finally, after a week of protests, the newly appointed president of Gallaudet has decided to resign before even taking office, so to speak. Tonight, we also hear from the world's most acerbic, laconic, dry, sardonic jazz vocalist, Mose Allison.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The magic and comedy team of Penn and Teller want to teach you how to con your friends with some neat tricks. Critic Ken Tucker has a review of their new home video cassette.
Penn and Teller have built a career out of making snide jokes about magic acts while performing some pretty amazing magic tricks themselves. Penn Jillette, the tall, loud one, and Teller, the short, silent one, have performed on and off Broadway, on television, and now on video cassette. Penn and Teller's Cruel Tricks for Dear Friends is an hour's worth of clever meanness. The basic idea is set forth by Penn at the start of the tape.
This tape is a tool for you to humiliate your friends and take their money. Although you may experience a great deal of pleasure in using this tape, it is not good, clean fun. We are encouraging you to laugh at your friends and not with them. If you want good, clean fun, ask your aunt to take you bowling.
That's the essential attitude here. Sarcasm so aggressive it becomes funny. There's also the assumption that we are as smart as Penn and Teller and live in a world populated by rubes waiting to be exploited. The fact that this assumption is both flattering and insulting at the same time is what makes these guys more interesting than Doug Henning. The tape includes seven tricks, or scams as they prefer to call them. They're pretty clever, and a few of them might actually fool an exceptionally gullible dear friend of yours. Most of them involve using the video cassette itself for the punchline of the scam. For instance, one card trick climaxes when, having asked your friend to pick a card, any card, you turn on your VCR only to see that card shimmer into view on the TV screen. While Penn and Teller make much of the fact that this is an interactive tape, most viewers, I suspect, will use it the same way they would any other comedy video, as a source of amusement in itself, as a sharp-witted parody of all instructional video cassettes.
Take your deck of cards, pull out the five of diamonds, and with a razor blade, very carefully cut out the center diamond. This is one of the few examples in life where neatness actually counts. We call this trick the diamond and the dope, and it's so simple, it has no right to be as good as it is. Take your doctored five of diamonds and put it in the deck. Put the deck near the TV and wait for the doorbell to ring. When old microbrain arrives, you tell him...
The main consumer warning I'd offer here is that, as assiduously hip as it is, Cruel Tricks for Dear Friends is essentially a novelty item. Watch it once and you've got all the good jokes. It's not something you'll want to see over and over, unless you plan to practice being singularly obnoxious to your pals. Other new video cassette releases include Matewan, director John Sayles' drama about a 1920 West Virginia coal miner's strike, and Hamburger Hill, the most conventional of all the recent revisionist movies about Vietnam, and the one with the most noticeably conservative politics as well.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time I'll talk with Ian Whitcomb, a British singer and writer who's obsessed with American songs from Tin Pan Alley. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead will review Cracked Sidewalks, the new album from tenor saxophonist Rich Hawley. Hawley lives in Oregon, and Kevin says his album is a reminder that not all the good musicians live in New York. And television critic David Bianculli reviews The Wonder Years, a new ABC series that looks back on a boy's junior high school days of 1968. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty, Lisa Bruton, and Deborah Beagle. Our engineer is Thad Kirk. Chris Spurgeon and Lisa Bruton directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.